facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Fantastic Friday to you. Welcome to the program. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We've got so much to talk about. We had such a great week on the show, and later on, producer Jim is going to be spinning another classic episode of the week that was. Can't wait for that. Got that to look forward to. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. You can also email the program, Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com, and follow me on Twitter, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is at Cale Clark Show. We have a lot to discuss. Today's the feast day of St. Jerome, maybe the greatest scripture scholar in the history of the church. He was well known, at least he's portrayed in a lot of famous paintings, like one by Caravaggio. He had a skull on his desk. Whether or not he did, I'm not sure, but he certainly battled a lot of temptations of flesh and spirit. And speaking of skulls, we do have to talk about the frightening concussion suffered by Tua Tagovailoa last night in the game between the Dolphins and the Cincinnati Bengals on Thursday Night Football. It's really sparked another national conversation about CTE. And I'm kind of wondering what you think of this. If you have a son, would you let your son play football? Maybe he's already playing. Do you want to pull him out of it? You might be a young person who actually does play football. Is this giving you second thoughts? Have you ever suffered a traumatic brain injury via concussion, had to fight your way back from it? I want to hear from you. 888-914-9149. I'm almost wondering whether we need another Saint Telemachus to step into the fray. I'll tell you who he is later on. So we have lots to get to today. Once again, 888-914-9149 is the number to call. But I want to talk about St. Jerome, because on his feast day, he's one of my absolute favorite saints. And not just because I love Scripture, he loves Scripture, hopefully we all love Scripture. And of course, he penned that famous line, "Ignorance of Scripture is ignorance of Christ." I'll give you the full context of that quote. It's often taken slightly out of context later on. But one of the things I like about St. Jerome is not just his emphasis on Scripture. It's something we try to do here at Relevant Radio on the Faith Explained program. Right now, we're going through the book of Exodus. It's been a really fun series, and I hope you'll join me for that. You can always get the podcasts, and maybe you can even binge listen to them on the weekend. RelevantRadio.com, the app, wherever you get your podcasts, we're everywhere. We're fine. Podcasts are pervade. Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you name it. I don't know if we're as popular as Joe Rogan, but we are on Spotify, I can tell you that. But the thing I like about St. Jerome, aside from, in any sane world, I'd be more, no, just kidding, but people should want to know about the Scriptures. But one of the things I like about St. Jerome is that he was so real. He was not a plasticine saint by any stretch of the imagination. He actually struggled a lot with his own predilection to sin, with the concupiscence that we all have, even post-baptism. And he had a lot of fights with people, even other saints, people who criticized him. They had to beware of his sharp tongue and his rebukes. One of the things that he said, here's a quote from him, "I frankly confess that I get carried away with indignation. I cannot listen to sacrilege with patience." He just had no patience whatsoever for false ideas or people that he thought were hypocrites or ignorant. And he attacked a lot of the heretics that were out there, all the false teachers, false ideas of his world. But he also had his share of spats with saints. I think if he were alive today, he'd probably be having a lot of Twitter beefs with people. He'd be on Catholic Twitter just fighting with people. He had battles against John Chrysostom, St. John Chrysostom. We talked about him, the golden mouth, the great preacher of the age, contemporary of St. Jerome. He kind of sparred against Ambrose of Milan, Basil of Caesarea, and even the great St. Augustine of Hippo. Those two went at it. And he actually had this term. He said that anybody who disagreed with him was a, quote, two-legged donkey. Well, he didn't use the word donkey. He used the other word, starts with an A, but you get the point. Anybody who disagreed with him was essentially wrong. So, but having said that, it's a great example that a lot of saints had personality, to put it mildly. And also, personality defects, I guess you could say. And God can use that, even the rough edges in our personality, in order to help us reach other people and actually to help us become saints. One of the things that St. Jose Maria Escrivá said was that if your character and the character of everybody around you was as soft and sweet as a marshmallow, you would never become a saint. You need those sort of rough edges and the rough edges of others to sometimes, you know, we come up against those. It's a little bit like iron sharpening iron, as it says in the book of Proverbs. It helps us to kind of, conflict can be a good thing in some ways, sometimes, but it's a good reminder that God does use our personality to shape us into saints. And there's that great acronym, the word SHAPE, S-H-A-P-E. The S stands for spiritual gifts. We all have them. The H stands for your heart. In other words, what you're passionate about. That's a big key to God's plan for your life. The A is natural abilities. I wish I could play on the PGA Tour, but it's not happening. I don't have the ability. The P is personality, and that's really, St. Jerome had that in spades. And the E stands for experiences, life experiences, because God never wastes an experience, good or bad. And he uses even the bad experiences to bring good out of them. Ultimately, we think about the crucifixion of Christ, the worst thing that ever could have happened. People killed God, but God used that to bring about our salvation. And he does that in the little things as well as the major events of life as well. St. Paul says in Romans 8:28, all things work for the good of those who love God. We're called according to his purpose. And his purpose is, of course, that we become saints. Now, St. Jerome, and you're listening to the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio, 888-914-9149. St. Jerome was born in the year AD 348. And it was kind of said that even when he was young, he was like an old man. And maybe you've known people like that, people who are kind of an old soul, as it were. He was really like that, but maybe not in a good way. Maybe he came out of the womb kind of crotchety and kind of always complaining. But he actually was really drawn to the classics, classical learning, like the great philosophers like Aristotle and writers like Cicero. And he often felt guilty about that. He felt guilty that it was too pagan and it was too, he wasn't devoting himself enough to Christ. This is sort of an interior battle that he had to deal with throughout his entire life. And he actually had this dream at one point. It's a famous account from the life of St. Jerome. He had this dream where he was at the final judgment. It's the end of the world. He's standing at the judgment seat of Christ. And Christ asks him, "Who are you? Who are you?" It's a very good question. And St. Jerome replied in the dream, "I am a Christian." And the judge said back to him, Christ said back to him, "You lie. You are not a Christian. You are a Ciceronian. You are a Ciceronian. You're more concerned about what Cicero thinks than what I think," in other words. It'd be kind of like today. I don't know what if someone were to have that dream today, God might say to them, "You're not a Christian. You're a Kardashian," you know, because you're more concerned about what's going on in social media and the lives of celebrities than what I think. So at any rate, this was the temptation and sort of the inner tension that was always in the life of St. Jerome, that he loved the classics, but he felt like they were in some ways pulling him away from devotion to Christ. So what he decided to do was just kind of throw himself 100% into scripture study. And he tried to live the life of an austere monk. He also really struggled with temptations of the flesh. And he thought that becoming a monk would kind of relieve him of that burden, that if he entered this life, that he would never, ever, ever have to struggle with any kind of temptations to impurity. And that's not how it works, because God needs to heal us from the inside out. And so he had all these great temptations where he had memories of, you know, dancing. You know, he went to see these, I guess you could say they're sort of exotic dancers in Rome, and he always had these memories of that, and he could never get these images out of his mind. And so he would punish his body. There's a story where he threw himself into kind of a thorn bush to kind of just mortify himself and get his thoughts away from such things. And some say that he even didn't really take care of himself. He was kind of unkempt. He kind of let himself go. Maybe he wasn't showering as often as he should have. Not that there were showers back then, but he actually said at one point, "Hey, I've been washed by Christ, so therefore there's no need for me to ever take a bath again." Well, okay, I don't know if the people around you would agree with that, but at any rate, he said, "Look, I've got to throw myself into scripture studies." And what he really wanted to do was he decided to study Hebrew, of course, the language of the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures. And he actually thought that Hebrew was, I mean, he'd read all these classics, like classical Greek literature, and he thought, man, like in comparison, he thought that Hebrew was kind of a rough language. But he said, hey, if the Old Testament was written in Hebrew, it's got to be from God. And a lot of rabbis will say that. I've heard rabbis say that, hey, if there's no word for something in Hebrew, that concept cannot exist. Why? Because Hebrew is the divine language, the language of God, at least in the Old Covenant time. I remember once hearing a rabbi talking about the fact that, hey, there's no such thing as retirement. Why? Because retirement, the word is not in the scriptures. Well, there are a lot of words that aren't in the scriptures, but you talk about whether the concept makes sense or not, and maybe it doesn't, but that's kind of what Jerome decided to do. He's like, I've got to just immerse myself in Hebrew. So he tried to become a monk. That didn't really work out for him. He goes back to Antioch. He's ordained as a priest. He's in Constantinople during the famous Church Council of Constantinople in 381 AD, and eventually gets back to Rome. And Pope Damasus at the time, everyone kind of needs a champion in life, somebody to really believe in you and your gifts. And Pope Damasus was like that for Jerome. And he was kind of a good judge of character. And he said, you know what? I see a lot of talent in you. And so he made the young priest, Jerome, his private secretary. And he's like, you've got a gift for studying scripture. You've got a gift for writing. And I really want you to kind of develop that. And in fact, it was Pope Damasus who suggested to him what became his massive life work, St. Jerome. Hey, why don't you do this? Why don't you create a new translation of the Bible, of all of scripture, into Latin? Which is, of course, now Latin is the official language of the church and its theological documents. But of course, scripture was written in the Old Testament time in Hebrew, a little bit of Aramaic in there as well, and in the New Testament in Greek. He's like, hey, why don't you create a fresh translation of the Bible into Latin? And so he did a little bit of that while he was in Rome, but most of it didn't happen until later when he got to the Holy Land. Now, here's another thing about St. Jerome. He had trouble connecting with, he didn't have a lot of guy friends. And maybe it's just because of his personality, he turned people off. He was so curmudgeonly and hard to get along with. Maybe people said, we don't want to deal with this guy. But he didn't really have a lot of guy friends. But he did find this community of devout women who used to basically come to his frequent Bible studies, I guess you could say. He taught them. There were all these devout women who lived in this palace. There was a rich widow by the name of Albina in Rome, and she would sort of gather her friends and say, hey, we're going to invite Jerome over and give us a little Bible study. Okay, cool. So they would do this kind of on a weekly basis. And so she was there. Albina was there, and also her daughter, Marcella, who was a widow, the sister of St. Ambrose, believe it or not, Marcellina, also showed up to this group. And then there was this woman named Paula. And Paula was like really bright. She could have been a professor, you know, in the modern age. And Paula was really into scripture, and she had a daughter. Paula had a daughter named Eustochium, which is, you know, maybe a strange name to us, but Eustochium was the name of her daughter. And these two became especially close to St. Jerome. In fact, there's paintings of the three of them where he's teaching them about the scriptures. They're pretty popular. And so they were kind of like very, very close friends for the rest of Jerome's life. And so he really loved this. Jerome was really coming alive at this time. This was really his gift. This is what he was born to do. And so he, unfortunately, because of his personality, made a lot of enemies in Rome. And when Pope Damasus died in the year 384 AD, his sort of champion was gone. And so it's a little bit like when a football coach, you know, gets fired, then all of his assistants gets fired as well, because the new guy wants to kind of clean house and bring in his own team. And the new pope, Siricius, he really didn't like Jerome. He wasn't a fan of his at all, and he says, I don't like his teaching. He's really hard to get along with, and you know what? I don't really want him around. And so he was kind of set aside, cast aside. And so there was actually a kind of a rumor that spread about Jerome as well, and this had to do with Paula, one of his great students. Paula had another daughter, not the one I talked about, Eustochium. She had another daughter who died. And some people spread the rumor that, well, the reason why she died is because St. Jerome demanded that she live this really austere life. And St. Jerome was known to be incredibly austere. And she just couldn't handle it. And in fact, she died because of it. So all these rumors swirling around him, that wasn't true at all. He's like, forget it. The new pope doesn't like me. Everybody seems to hate me. I'm out of here. So he decides to go to the Holy Land. So he went from, as he said, he went from Babylon to Jerusalem. He went from Rome, he called it Babylon, and he went from there to Jerusalem. And Paula and her daughter Eustochium also kind of came with him, and they all took a pilgrimage together in the Holy Land. Now, Jerome, he decided to go to Egypt because he wanted to meet some of the famous desert monks of Egypt, known for their piety, so he kind of hung out with them for a little bit. And then he also went to Alexandria. You've probably heard of the famous ancient library of Alexandria. Was kind of like, that's where some of the great scholars hung out. So he was there for a little bit, and then he came back to the Holy Land. He came back to Palestine in 386 AD. And so what they did was, he said, hey, Paula, I want you to basically start a monastery for women. I want you to create this community of nuns, and I'm going to do the same, and I'm going to create a community of monks. So that's kind of what they did. And so they kind of created this life of study, prayer, kind of just being austere. Paula was from, she had a lot of personal wealth, so she was able to kind of write the checks for this and fund the process. And Jerome had a bit of family money as well. So they started up these two houses, one for women and one for men. He kept studying Hebrew. He was in the Holy Land. He learned Hebrew really, really well. And he started his big project of translating the Bible. Now, here's what's interesting. He eventually did. This is an incredible task to create what's called the Vulgate. You might have heard of the Vulgate. And that became the Bible in the Catholic Church, I guess you could say, in the Latin-speaking church. But in the beginning, a lot of people didn't like it. A lot of people were actually pretty angry with Jerome because they're like, who are you to translate scripture? Who do you think you are? You can't mess with this. You can't mess with this. There used to be a Greek translation of the Old Testament called the Septuagint. And we know the New Testament was written in Greek already, so that was kind of all set for Greek speakers. There's something called the Septuagint. And the reason why it's called the Septuagint, sometimes you see it abbreviated as LXX, if you've ever read that, what does this mean? That's the Septuagint. It's the Latin number, the Latin numerals for, Roman numerals rather, for 70, because there is this, it's kind of an urban legend that there were 70 translators who worked on this translation of the Bible, the Old Testament. And when they all worked independently, they miraculously all came up with the same translation into Greek, all 70 of them working independently. And they all met up as a group and they're like, hey, we all came up with the same answer. It's an urban legend. Didn't happen, but people used to say, this is the only translation of the Old Testament that's right, because these 70 guys all agreed on it. And that probably in all likelihood did not happen. And Jerome's translation of the Bible had a few disagreements here and there in the way he translated certain passages. So some people said, oh, Jerome, you don't respect the Bible. You're just trying to change everything. And it wasn't just sort of anybody on the street who would say this stuff to St. Jerome, even big time saints. This is where he had this big fight with St. Augustine. St. Augustine said this. He said, quote, I pray you, Jerome, not to devote your energies to translating the sacred books into Latin, unless you do so like you did when you translated the book of Job before, that add notes that show where your version is different from the Septuagint, whose authority has no equal, by the way. And then he said, this is Augustine speaking, I cannot imagine how, Jerome, after so long, somebody can find in the Hebrew manuscripts anything which so many translators did not see before, especially since they knew Hebrew so well. So he's basically saying, you don't know what you're doing. You're messing around with the scripture. You need to stop it. Your translation is trash, essentially. So, whoa. So, hey, the saints often didn't even like one another, you know, on a personal level. Hopefully they loved one another, because you don't have to necessarily have fuzzy feelings towards someone to have love and charity towards them. But so they were like not on good terms, Jerome and St. Augustine. In fact, Jerome, at first, he never answered the letter from St. Augustine. And then he finally did. And he said, hey, Augustine, you're just a young punk. I'm paraphrasing here, obviously. And you're just trying to make yourself a superstar by criticizing people like me, kind of getting famous by debating with people like me. And by the way, if we ever had a debate, I would wipe the floor. Don't even try it. I'd destroy you. And it wouldn't even be a fair fight. So it's like, wow, these guys are really going at it. Now, just so you know, they did make up in the end. They did kind of become friends at the end, because there's this bad group of bad guys called the Pelagians. They're basically a bunch of false teachers. They're really dangerous. And St. Jerome used to use Augustine's writings to try to fight against them. So he was an interesting dude, wasn't he, St. Jerome? And this is his feast day today. And maybe you can kind of identify with him. He wasn't perfect, but he tried. He tried really hard to become a saint, and he did. God made him a saint. And I just want to read to you, just in closing, the last thing that he wrote that we know of. When the Roman Empire was sacked, when it was taken over by the Goths, you know, they weren't a bunch of teens dressed in black clothing or anything like that. No. These are bad guys. I mean, these are like Gothic barbarians, essentially. And Alaric, you might have heard of this guy. He was commander of that group. And so Rome was sacked by the Goths, the Visigoths, if you will. And everyone was shocked. This went all over the world. It was on CNN. No, they didn't have that back then. But everybody heard about this. And Jerome heard about the fall of the Roman Empire, if you will, in Bethlehem. And he wrote to Paul, his daughter, Eustochium. He said, who could have believed that Rome, built by the conquest of the world, would ever fall? The mother of many nations has turned to her grave. My eyes are dim by my advanced age. And with the light that I have at night, I can no longer read Hebrew books, which is difficult even during the day because of the smallness of their letters. And I can't even see anymore. I'm so sad to hear about what happened to Rome. But he went on to live for another 10 years, but he was very lonely. He was full of pain. And Paul's daughter, Eustochium, who had kind of become a daughter to him, passed away. And soon after that, Jerome died as well. So, great scripture scholar. Just before we go to break, one thing. We did do a show on this a couple years ago. I think it's the best thing, in my humble opinion, I think it's the best thing Pope Francis ever wrote. Pope Francis came out with a surprise letter on this day in 2020 on St. Jerome and scripture scholarship. And it's an amazing letter. It's an apostolic letter. If you can look that up, you can Google it, the letter from Pope Francis on St. Jerome. It's incredible. I talked about this when it first came out on the show. And it's still to this day, stands the test of time, and I think everybody should read it. And anyways, but if you have questions about that, you can call in 888-914-9149. And when we come back, St. Jerome had a skull on his desk. We're going to talk about CTE and the incredibly dangerous, frightening moment that happened last night. 888-914-9149. It's Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. Be right back. Today, we'd like to thank Teodoro, who's listening in New Jersey, for donating his Mercedes. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car.
Faith, facts, and fun. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the program. 888-914-9149. Just before the break, we talked about the fact that today is the feast day of St. Jerome. Great scripture scholar, great hero to many, really inspiring in so many ways. So if you missed that segment, you're definitely going to want to check that out on the podcast, which should be available within the hour after the show. Just check wherever you get your podcasts, and also on relevantradio.com and on the app. And please share it with a friend. Spread the good word about the show. Well, last night I sat down, as I often do, to watch Thursday Night Football, which is now under the contract to Amazon Prime. They have the contract in Kirk Herbstreit. He's a great analyst, usually known for his college work, his work in the NFL now for Amazon Prime, along with the great Al Michaels, legendary broadcaster. And last night, you probably heard about this by now, Miami Dolphins quarterback, they're playing against the Cincinnati Bengals. Late in the second quarter, Tua Tagovailoa suffered what I actually thought for a moment that we might be seeing a death on an NFL field. And this is something that Roger Goodell, commissioner of the NFL, something that's haunted him, this idea that this could happen for many, many years. It's one of the reasons why the NFL has been pushing for some time to try to change the rules on tackling and heavily penalize players who lead with the crown of their helmet for their own safety as well as the people that they're hitting. But I know it's something that that keeps him awake at night. And last week, just to set this up, one of the reasons why this became even more controversial was because last week when the Dolphins were playing against the Buffalo Bills, it was a classic game. But Tua was hit by Bills linebacker Matt Milano. He kind of pushed him. It looked pretty innocuous. I don't think he was trying to injure him at all. Tua fell back and hit the back of his head against the turf, got up, was incredibly wobbly. He almost fell down a couple times. And when I saw that, I said immediately, he's got a concussion. He was taken away, put into concussion protocol, quote unquote, where he was evaluated and cleared by the Dolphins team doctor, as well as an independent doctor who looks at neurological issues like this. Every team has one. He was sent back into the game, finished the game, and they called it a back injury, but it was pretty clear to everybody. I'm no expert, but those who are experts were saying this was a concussion. And so just 4 days later, he's playing on Thursday Night Football against the Bengals, and then this happened. I'm going to let Al Michaels and Kirk Herbstreit make the call on Amazon Prime. This is from last night. Check it out.
His ability to make adjustments at halftime.
To a rolling left with the grain, and down he goes. Slung down at his own 48-yard line. Josh Tupu. And, Well, we saw last week, and he went down, he got up, was wobbly. The training staff comes out. And, of course, the last thing the Dolphins wanted to see. I mean, last week it looked for all the world. Everybody thought head injury, concussion, passed the protocol, came back second half, led him to a victory.
And Al Tupou slams him to the ground. I mean, it's you're thinking about the back, the ankle, but he gets thrown to the ground.
Again, wrenching that back, which was the issue last week.
Yep.
So they work on him. We'll step away for a moment.
It wasn't quite the back. He was twisted around. And if you didn't see the clip, it's all over the internet. But the Bengals linemen essentially violently threw down Tua Tagovailoa. And once again, the back of his head hit the turf violently. And then he had this reaction. This is where Al Michaels said, uh-oh. And when I saw this, I was almost sick to my stomach. His hands, there's something that happens sometimes to concussion victims, and they do something that's called fencing, where it looks like they're fencing because their arms are kind of stuck out as if they're fencing against someone. And this is a reaction that occurs sometimes when you have a concussion. But his fingers, it wasn't just that. His fingers were also twisted into a, and I'm not trying to be flip when I say this, but it looked almost like Spider-Man trying to fire his web shooters. Like his fingers were kind of bent backwards, and they were all at strange angles. And I thought, oh my goodness, this is horrible. This is not good. So I'm not a doctor. I don't play one on the radio either. So I'm going to let a professional explain this to you. I want to play you a little clip from Dr. Brian Suterer. Dr. Brian Suterer is a sports medicine physician, has a very large following on YouTube, well over 600,000 subscribers. In fact, he had a video explaining what happened last night in this game. It was the number 4 trending video on all of YouTube today. So everybody is talking about this. Everybody is talking about this. As one of our own VPs here at Relevant Radio, Mike Kendall, likes to say, really, you could say football is the American religion. It shouldn't be necessarily, but I love football. I feel guilty about this sometimes because of things like this that happen, and we'll talk about that in a bit. I want to ask you as well to call in 888-914-9149. Did you see this? What was your reaction to it? Do you have any second thoughts about maybe putting your own kids into football? Or maybe you're a player yourself, maybe you're a young person who's playing. Or have you suffered? Has anybody out there ever suffered a serious concussion like this or a series of them and had to fight your way back from it? And when I saw the clip, when somebody has a concussion, what I do know is this. I'm not a specialist, but I do know that when somebody suffers two concussions in quick succession like this, it can be life-threatening. And there's every chance that, and Tua is very, very lucky because, very blessed because he was able to, he has movement in all his extremities. He was taken to a hospital. He's going to be able to walk away from this for now, but that could have easily wound up in his death last night. And so I'm going to let Dr. Brian Suter explain this. So check this out.
On this play, Tua falls backward and basically hits his head on the turf again, kind of similar to what we saw happen last week. It's a combination of whiplash, his head striking the turf. So again, a clear mechanism for a brain injury, brain trauma. What we witness afterwards then with Tua having his hands sort of contorted in that awkward position is what we call posturing, right? This is similar to the fencing response that we can see, these abnormal posturings that occur in the setting of significant brain injuries or concussion. His fingers are rigid like that because of this continuous electrical signal being sent to those muscles as a result of that head trauma. We saw something like this with Donald Parham last year where he was having those shaking kind of tremors of his arms. And so this is on that same scale of what we can see in the body and the limbs as a result of trauma to the brain.
Okay, so there's the technical explanation from Dr. Brian Suter there. And Donald Parham, the other name that he was referring to there, was a player for the Los Angeles Chargers. And during a nationally televised game, this something similar happened to him last year. And again, what looked like to be an innocuous play, but his head had hit the turf and he got into this quote-unquote fencing position. So posturing was what happened to Tua last night. But it was horrific to watch. And just looking at, and this happened shortly before halftime, during the halftime show, former NFL quarterback Ryan Fitzpatrick, Richard Seymour, he used to play for the Seahawks, and Tony Gonzalez, who's former tight end for the Kansas City Chiefs, they were all pretty emotional even talking about this. Fitzpatrick saying he's seen a lot of injuries on the football field, but that was probably the worst that he's ever seen happen in person. Truly frightening. And everyone was quite emotional. Even today, Rob Ninkovich, who played for the New England Patriots, won a couple Super Bowls with them on Get Up on ESPN this morning. He talked about very emotionally, because he saw this up close, because he had a couple of teammates. He was teammates with Aaron Hernandez, who, as you know, tragically became a murderer, in part because of traumatic brain injuries that he suffered playing football. There's a Netflix documentary about Aaron Hernandez, who wound up murdering a man named Lloyd Oden, and then wound up, unfortunately, committing suicide himself in prison. They examined his brain, and it had been severely damaged by CTE and the many concussions he'd suffered. And also, Rob Ninkovich played with Junior Seau, who was one of the greatest players in the history of the NFL, who also suffered from CTE. And after his career ended, he ended his own life tragically as well. Here's Rob Ninkovich talking about the toll that this takes and what Tua might regret about deciding to play in future years. Check this out.
For a player to go down, when you get knocked out, you don't know what happened. I've been knocked out. You get up, you're like, whoa, what happened? I'm okay. I can go. I can play. It's up to someone else, a medical expert or someone that witnesses that, to say, no. You just got knocked out. You don't know what happened. You might say it's your back, but we know. We saw it. So the NFL has to do a better job in knowing what to do if they see someone get injured the way that he got injured. It wasn't his back. You don't sit up, shake your head to get the cobwebs out, stand up, do it again, start to run, and stumble on yourself if you have a back injury. It was a head issue on Sunday. They say it's a back issue. He plays Thursday night, 4 days later, and gets a massive concussion where he's froze up. So that's a problem, and it's a bad look. I have children. I have kids. After you watch that, you don't want your kid to play football. And you see all these commercials on safety of the game and future of the game. Technology is shaping the future of the game with helmets. But how do you protect the player on the field to where he doesn't have to fight through an injury to say, hey, you know what? I'm fine. I can go out here. I can play. I'm good. It's the doctors. It's your coaches. It's the NFL. They need to say, no, no, no. We need to have a better protocol in place to make sure that players don't put themselves in harm's way. Because that the 44-year-old Tua is going to look back at the 24-year-old Tua and say, why did I do this? Now I have a family. Now I have people that rely on me to be around. And I've seen too many guys that are going through a lot of stuff. And it's unfortunate. I sat next to Junior Seau, was my locker mate next to me. And I had to see things that you don't want to see that happen to people. So I don't want families to go through it. And you don't know. You don't know. You don't know. There's an unknown here to the future. How long you played football with contact. What's in store for me? What's in store for everyone that played? It's an unknown. But it's your families that are going to be by your side down the road. You know, the head coach can go up and tap you on the shoulder, give you, you know, hold your hand while you're going off the field. He's not going to be there 20 or 30 years down the road when you're dealing with a problem. It's going to be your wife and your kids.
A powerful words, very poignant words from Rob Ninkovich speaking on Get Up this morning on ESPN. I want to hear from you. A lot of you guys are calling in right now, 888-914-9149. What do you think about this? And have you experienced this yourself? Traumatic concussions and the fallout from that. We're going to go to the phones right now. Kiva is on the line from Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, Kiva.
Hello, Mr. Clark.
Oh, hi, Kiva. How old are you, Kiva?
I'm 15.
You're 15. Okay, well, thanks for calling in. What are your thoughts on this?
So, 5 years ago, I was 10 and in third grade. Mm-hmm. And on Good Friday, my mom and I and my aunt went on a horseback ride. I was not wearing a helmet, and my saddle had a nylon cinch, which is very slippery when the horse starts to sweat. So we went into a gallop, and then we made a sharp turn, and the nylon cinch slipped, and it threw me off. I hit my head on the ground, and my horse was still running. And then he stopped by my mom, and so my mom turned around. She looked back.
Oh my
she
goodness.
Jumped off her horse and found me, and my eyes were open like a dead person. So she was crying to my aunt, like, call 911, and so she did. And my mom carried me, not knowing that she could have broken my neck. And then we went to the hospital. I was in a coma. I kept making sounds. And they had put a cone, like a cone of shame, around my neck, and I kept clawing at it, so they had to tie me down, like Jesus on the cross, as my mom's now talking to me. And I went to that coma until Easter Sunday, and my heart, because my brain was so injured, my heart would stop beating sometimes, but they couldn't intubate me because of the brain injury. And so they would have to manually pump my heart and make sure that it was still beating. And then on Easter Sunday at 6 a.m. in the morning, I woke up and I saw my mom to the right of me. And I asked my mom, where am I? And she said, you're in the hospital, baby. You fell off the horse. And I said, nuh-uh, I'm way too good a rider for that. Yes, and now I'm 15 and I'm all healed. And my dad, who's a chiropractor, when I was still going through my rehabilitation and stuff, he knows a lot about concussions. So he would have me stand and close my eyes and put my hands by my side. And if I was shaking, he could tell how badly injured I was. And for the first 2 weeks, I had to just sit in bed and stare at nothing and basically take naps all day because I wasn't allowed to have any activity going on in my brain.
You're right. Right.
And then for the next 2 weeks, I could only have half days at school, and the fastest I could go was a fast walk. And then after that, I was all fine, and I'm perfectly fine today. I have no brain injury, and I'm as smart as I ever was, and I'm all better.
Oh, well, thanks be to God. Thanks be to God, Kiva. What a blessing to be able to make that full recovery, and there is no doubt that your guardian angel was watching out for you, because that easily could have gone the other way. And just even what you're saying, when your mom was carrying you, she could have inadvertently broken your neck and not known that. And we saw that last night when when Tua Tagovailoa was carried off the field on that special board that they to immobilize you, because you don't know what you're dealing with. There might be a chance of something like that, a spinal injury. And that's such a powerful story, Kiva. I'm so glad that you called in, and thanks to your mom as well for encouraging you to do that. There's a lot of symbolism there. This happened on Good Friday. You come back to on Easter Sunday, and I'm sure that was a very, very long and difficult journey to get back, but so beautiful that you didn't lose your sense of humor and when you woke up said, there's no way that happened. I'm too good of a rider for this to happen. So, oh, wow. It's almost like your parents received you metaphorically back from the dead. I'm sure that's what it felt like. And so what an incredible testimony. What a powerful story. Kiva, God bless you. Thank you for calling in. Thank you for calling in. And that's an amazing story. Wow. We have to take a little break here, but many others are calling in right now. 888-914-9149. What a powerful call from Kiva, 15-year-old in Phoenix, who suffered a very, very traumatic brain injury and has made a full recovery. Thanks be to God. 888-914-9149. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We'll be right back. The Catholic Order of Foresters, the sponsor of our studio's line, is hiring today. Several positions are available throughout the United States. Visit relevantradio.com/forester to learn more about how you can find your vocation with Catholic Order of Foresters, an Illinois Life Insurance Society, not licensed in all states.
Helping you keep your mind off traffic and on the more important things in life. It's Cale Clark on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back to the program. We're going to get back to your calls in just a moment. 888-914-9149. A lot of you guys are reacting to the really traumatic brain injury that was no doubt suffered by Tua Tagovailoa yesterday, last night, Thursday Night Football. And it's really raised a national conversation about brain injury. Once again, has come to the fore. But before we get to those calls, producer Jim's been working really, really hard on this. We want to share it with you. It's the week that was. A little snapshot of what you missed on the Cale Clark Show this week. I wanted to share with you some incredibly beautiful advice from a divorced man. His name was Gerald Rogers. Basically 20 things that he wished he had known or done differently. He says, never stop courting. Never stop dating. Never ever, he says, take that woman for granted. When you asked her to marry you, you promised to be that man who would own her heart and fiercely protect it. He says, just as you committed to be the protector of her heart, you must guard your own with the same vigilance. And I don't know if he knows this, but this kind of echoes the teaching of the Bible. It says, above all, guard your heart, for the wellspring of life comes from the heart. And Jesus talked about that. Out of the heart come all the various sins that people commit. Cardinal Gerhard Mueller said to an Italian news organization, from the silence of this consistory on the Cardinal Zen case, I have fears. He said, perhaps the church should be freer and less bound to power-based worldly logic, freer to intervene and, if necessary, to criticize politicians who end up suppressing human rights. Cardinal Mueller went on to say, Cardinal Zen is a symbol and he was arrested on a pretext. He did nothing. He is an influential, courageous, and much feared figure by the government. And we have left him all alone, end of quote. And I retweeted, by the way, a tweet from Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco requesting everyone to pray for Cardinal Zen. He's specifically asking us to invoke Our Lady, Undoer of Knots, for this intention. The writer Joe Rigney, who says, you can sum up the story of Jesus in 6 words. I love this. Kill the dragon, get the girl. That is exactly why Jesus became incarnate. That's why he is the hero of the story. Not just any story, but the story. That's the plot of the Bible. Jesus came to crush the Satan, the great dragon, and save, quote unquote, the girl, his bride, the church. Giorgia Meloni, who is the prime minister-elect of Italy. She has some pretty hot takes of her own on the family, country, God, really the nature of reality.
Why is the family an enemy? Why is the family so frightening? There is a single answer to all these questions, because it defines us, because it is our identity.
Patrick, I have to ask you, first of all, how long have you known Italian? This is a secret talent that you've had.
I've known Italian for 10 seconds.
So she's hit on something that's really important. As the family goes, so goes the culture. And I think that St. John Paul II knew this very, very well. And I think that was the key of his teaching on the theology of the body, because he knows it really, in the heart of the family is that relationship between husband and wife. And the heart of that relationship is the sexual union of the bodies of the man and wife. That's what makes it sacramental. If people can bring good out of evil without even thinking about God, how much more so if we make God a part of it? If we invite God into that suffering, because this is exactly what Jesus does. Jesus enters into that suffering. He is familiar with it. He's not untouched by it. And so we have to read Job, just like all the books in the Old Testament, in light of the new. Jude is so short. In verse 8 and 9, it says, in the same way, these dreamers, these false teachers, pollute their own bodies, reject authority, and slander celestial beings. But even the archangel Michael, when he was disputing with the devil about the body of Moses, did not dare to bring a slanderous accusation against him, but said, "The Lord rebuke you."
And the 3-2. Throw deep to left field. This could be it. See ya. He's done it. Number 61. He's been chasing history, and now he makes it.
The guy who almost caught the ball, apparently his name was Frankie Lasagna. I'm not making this up. Folks, the jokes pretty much write themselves.
La 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 lasagna.
Oh, we circled the bases this week on the Cale Clark Show. My thanks to producer Jim Shaper for another fantastic week that was. You can check out the actual full episodes, of course, in podcast form wherever you get your podcasts. Let's go back to the phones right now. Michael is in San Diego. Hi, Michael.
How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for calling in.
Good, no problem. So I'm a survivor and wanted to offer up a number of things. I'll do as best I can to keep it quick, but if you have some questions, I'm happy to entertain those as well. So to the guy on the clip, Rob, the announcer that called this one properly, that this was a brain injury and he shouldn't have been put in that position. That's the first thing. You know, as a follow-up from last week, you heard the brave young man at 15 say, look, it was weeks before I could do anything. Mm-hmm. We need to have accountability in industries where people are basically paid to play like this. And I'm sure from a sport professional's perspective, he wants to perform the best he can, but he shouldn't be put in that position. And people need to advocate on his behalf.
I agree with that. I've got to jump in here for a second, Michael. I think it's really important that I think Tua did, a lot of people aren't asking the question about what his role in this was. And I'm sure that he wanted to play. I'm sure he's in a contract year. I'm sure he wants to perform. But like Rob Ninkovich said on ESPN this morning, the 44-year-old version of Tua, as opposed to the 24-year-old version that he is right now, is going to look back and say, what was I thinking? Because he doesn't have that perspective. He doesn't have the weight of those years. And I think everybody's at fault here at some level for the fact that he was back in there last night. And that could have been literally deadly. I appreciate that call so much, Michael in San Diego. We're going to go now to Gary in Pittsburgh. Hi, Gary.
Yes, Sidney Crosby back in 2011, I believe it was then, had two concussions within days of each other. He was out for about a year and a half. Many people thought his career was over, in fact. Mm-hmm. Fortunately, his brain healed, and the Penguins won two Stanley Cups since then. And he spent many days in a closet in darkness. So it was horrific, but fortunately he survived, and it can happen. You can survive that.
That's a great point. He was able to make that recovery. It was touch and go for a while with Sidney Crosby. And Sidney Crosby, of course, is from my hometown, Coal Harbour, Nova Scotia. Well, it's probably better to say I'm from his hometown. But that is exactly what happened to him. I remember one game, an outdoor game in Buffalo, Winter Classic, where he got knocked cold, unconscious. And yeah, he spent many days in a dark room. And that's another thing that was strange about the Tua case as well. Marcel Louis Jacques, who covers the Dolphins for ESPN, he tweeted that on the flight. Tua was released from the hospital, able to fly back with the Dolphins. He was sitting with Mike, apparently with Dolphins coach Mike McDaniel on the plane. Allegedly, they were watching the MacGruber movie together, and Tua was laughing his head off. I don't think you're supposed to be looking at screens and stuff like that right after you've had a concussion like that, but this is how we know he had a concussion. He actually thought MacGruber was funny. So anyways, a little levity there, very little folks, but no, it's a serious situation, all kidding aside. And it certainly has once again opened up this conversation. And next week, I promise, I'll get to St. Telemachus and the gladiator fights of ancient Rome and what happened there. I didn't get to that. We ran out of time, but thanks to everybody who called in. Lewis, we didn't get your call. I apologize. He's doubtful that the league really cares about the players with these Thursday night games. And why are they playing so quickly after a Sunday game? And this is all about the money, all about the TV contracts. There's something to be said for that. Don't forget the players union agreed to all of this as well. So, but it is an issue that's something that needs to be looked at as well. They need a bit more of a break, and we're going to have a break too. Next time you'll talk to me is on Monday. But like I said, catch all the shows you missed in podcast form. Tim Reese up next, followed by Father Rocky, Family Rosary Across America. Jim Schaefer produced. Patrick Haluk took your phone calls. God bless you, everybody. I'm Cale Clark. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.